Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists discuss their most recent work. Today, I have the honor of speaking with Aaron Westgate, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Florida. The work from Aaron's lab has focused on topics such as thinking for pleasure and boredom, and has been featured in outlets such as the New York Times, CNN, and the BBC. Aaron has famously found that people would rather shock themselves than sit alone with their thoughts for a few minutes. In this episode, we discuss the question we all have in mind. Why? Why is that the case, more precisely? What makes thinking often so unpleasant? And how can we make it more pleasurable? How can we avoid boredom? And should we avoid it in the first place? I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and hope you do too. Very thrilled today to be talking with Aaron Westgate about a wonderful paper called What Makes Thinking for Pleasure Pleasurable. First of all, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what makes thinking for pleasure pleasurable? What is it? In very broad strokes, what is this wonderful sounding paper all about?
So we all have times, right, where we kind of find ourselves lost in thought and it's really pleasant. You know, you might be walking down a street and find yourself having this really pleasant kind of daydream. And we were really curious about like, wow, like, can we channel that and have people have that kind of thinking on demand, almost like this intentional daydreaming that you just sort of click your fingers and you have like fill your mind with fantastic thoughts, which like sounds great, right? And what we found over and over is that that's actually really tricky for people, that for thinking for pleasure to be pleasurable, as you put it, people have to be able to do it. So thinking is actually kind of hard. We academics kind of tend to be biased because we're a self-selected group that we all really like thinking. And so we, you know, we're not necessarily a nice representative population here, but it's really effortful. There's a lot of cognitive demand involved. And so you have to be able to think for pleasure. You have to have the cognitive resources available to do it successfully. But you also have to think about the right things. So just because you're able to concentrate on your thoughts doesn't mean you're going to have fun thoughts. Necessarily. You need to pick topics that are meaningful to think about, but that are also pleasant. So no one, for instance, is going to imagine that, you know, like my grandmother died a couple years ago. I love her. I love thinking about her in some sense. It's deeply meaningful. But if I think about, you know, the last time I saw her, I'm not going to come back after that and be like, wow, that was so much fun. You know, so it's meaningful. I can do it. But it's not a topic that's both meaningful and pleasant. So you need those three things. You need the ability to do it. And you need the right topics, something that's meaningful and pleasant in order to succeed at it.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you ask people, what did you do in your free time? Very, very rarely do you get the response that is like, well, I was, you know, just thinking, just sitting there thinking. It doesn't happen, right? You also have this wonderful opening quote from, I think this was from someone on Twitter of all places, who was just like, my favorite part of quarantine is that we were all forced to be alone with our thoughts for a while. And everyone was like, absolutely not. I will learn to bake bread from scratch instead.
I know. No, I study this and I got so many people sending me that tweet and I literally had a sourdough starter like on like the kitchen counter at the moment. And I was like, oh my God, like I am this tweet and I know better, but I am. And yeah, we actually did a study of that. Oh my goodness. It was one of the very first studies I ever did in grad school. I think we actually started talking about it at the lab meeting before my first semester of my first year started, where we essentially did like an experience sampling study, but it was a thought sampling study where we just texted people throughout the day and we're like, hey, what are you thinking about? And asked them to categorize their thoughts. And when you do that, I mean, this is like one of those studies that I tell my family about and they're like, you're going to school to learn what? Because like what we find is that the majority of the time, people are thinking about what they're doing. They're thinking about the external world. And when they are in their own thoughts, they're only having these kinds of really like lost in thought, pleasant kinds of intentional daydreams around 6% of the time. If you also look at spontaneous daydreams, that adds another 6 to 7%. So, you know, in some, you know, people are having this kind of thought maybe 10 to 15% of the time, which implies that 85 to 90% of the time, we're not, you know, lost in our own, pleasantly lost in our own thoughts. We might be baking bread.
So I was just going to ask about a somewhat more technical issue. So as a psychology student, the first thing I was thinking about, thinking for pleasure in an unfocused way, is the default mode network, right? So some neuroscientists have been like, people don't ever not use their brain. The brain is always active, and there are certain things we ruminate about, we think about when we're not engaged in any particular thing. And I just wanted to ask, is this the same as the thinking for pleasure or the thinking in an unfocused way that you're talking about, or is it different somehow?
I think it's different. Certainly, we always have, you know, sort of a background level of mental activity. And I've really loved the work that's been coming out on the default mode network. Like, I think it's sort of something that's sort of come out in time as we've been sort of doing this parallel but related in some ways research. And I think the kind of thinking that we're thinking about is more analogous to the kind of intentional thinking activity that like folks in scanners are asked to do. It's more akin to like doing math than it is to just sort of the background, sort of like free floating associations that, you know, you see in that kind of activity. That said, I would love to actually see what folks are doing like in a scanner when we're asking them to try to engage in this kind of intentional thought. We never have, so we have no idea, but I think it'd be really interesting to see, you know, if part of what makes it difficult is that, you know, you kind of want to rely on this sort of more free flowing, naturally occurring associations. And we do actually see in some data, for instance, that this kind of thinking is more enjoyable when it happens spontaneously. Mm-hmm. And so if there's something that happens when we try to sort of intentionally take command of it and channel it, that paradoxically makes it much harder to enjoy. We certainly see that with other processes, you know, how like people who really value happiness and try to pursue happiness, paradoxically end up being less happy, for instance. So it's clearly some really interesting, intricate interplay with these questions of intentionality and this sort of assumption of processes that are sort of naturally occurring without our input and what happens when we sort of try to intervene.
Yeah, I actually really, really like this finding. And I think many listeners might find this interesting. So what is this finding that the more we try to pursue happiness, the less happy we are just by trying to pursue it? And what's the analogy to thinking for pleasure?
Yeah, so this isn't work that we've done. This is work others have done. But there's an old chapter by Jonathan Schuller and folks that look at how intentionally trying to pursue happiness essentially backfires in some sense. That if you try really hard to be happy, you start monitoring your own happiness. And then you're not as happy as a result. But there's also really great work that's come out more recently. More recently, I'm starting to become that academic that's like, oh, that new paper that came out 7 years ago, you know, so relatively recent. But like looking at the same thing, that the more people, for instance, value happiness, the less happy they report actually being. And when you try to manipulate it experimentally, you actually see these sorts of things that, it doesn't work, which in some sense makes sense. Like if I said, like, Eric, be very happy right now. Like, can you do it? Like, can you make yourself really happy right now?
No.
No, okay. Yeah, no, it's tricky. And you know, and that's basically what these researchers find, which is that when you try to do this intentionally, that one, you can't really do it. But even worse, it actually may have the opposite effect, that when you become really aware of your own happiness, then you kind of are like so aware of monitoring it that you can't really experience it. I sometimes use the analogy of it's like when you suddenly become aware, or at least I do, like if I'm like just going about my day and I suddenly become aware that like I'm breathing, and then all that I can think about is like, oh my God, I'm breathing. And then like, I can't stop thinking about how I'm breathing, because then like I stop breathing and I'm like, this makes no sense. Everything was going fine until I started thinking about it. And you know, it's tied in too to this idea that, you know, the point of happiness isn't just to feel good. The point of happiness is to reward behaviors and actions in our lives that are sort of good for us. I was a student of Tim Wilson and, you know, did work with him and Dan Gilbert and folks. And obviously this is tied into ideas of affective forecasting, that it's good for us to believe that we're going to feel terrible if we don't, you know, get a job, or, you know, or if our dissertation defense goes, you know, upside down, we should think that that will be terrible, because then we're motivated to like make sure it's not. But if the worst happens and it is actually pretty bad, it's actually pretty advantageous for us not to to suffer from that forever. Like, it should feel a little bit bad to sort of punish that. But it's already happened. We can't do anything about it now. So it doesn't really make sense for that to be a devastating event, even if it does make sense for us to believe that it will be. And so I think that really ties into this work on, you know, that like pursuing happiness for its own sake isn't very effective, because you're sort of coming at it upside down, that if you want to, you know, experience happiness, and I don't know that work has been done on meaning in life or psychological richness, but I suspect this, you'd see similar effects, where if you want those things, you should pursue activities that lead to those things or circumstances that are conducive to that, rather than sort of trying directly to leapfrog to the end goal and like snap your fingers and be happy directly, that it's sort of a reward for a good life rather than an end in up into itself. And I think you see the same thing with thinking for pleasure, honestly, that like, you know, when we ask people to just think for pleasure, like on the spot, on average, they're not very good at it. So they're like on a 1 to 9 scale from like not at all enjoyable to like 9 is extremely enjoyable. They're like a 5. If we ask them to like rank it relative to other tasks, it's about the same as like brushing your teeth, for instance. Like, it's not torture. It's not like, oh my God, Aaron, you have to go brush your teeth now. Like, how terrible. But I also don't like wake up in the morning and be like, wow, I'm so happy I get to brush my teeth today. You know, it's just sort of boring, honestly. And I think, you know, so when we ask people to do it, they're not great at it. It's not fantastic. It's not terrible. It's just kind of boring. When we compare it to other kinds of external activities, like, you know, like reading a fun book, or, you know, watching a fun movie, those are all much more enjoyable than thinking fun thoughts. So, you know, we see the sort of general effect that like doing something is more enjoyable than thinking something. And, you know, in the one study, of course, we looked to see whether people would even, you know, give themselves electric shocks rather than just sort of sit and be alone with their own thoughts. And, you know, I loved this study, partly because, like, you know, when we were getting ready to do it, Tim was like, every social psychologist needs to run a shock study. It's like, he was being facetious, you know, it's this like, this rite of passage. And he was like, you know, like, I've spent my whole career and never shocked anyone. Like, we need to change this. And like, he'd hate on saying this. I'm so sorry, Tim, if you hear this. But, you know, we were like, it was a valid question. It's like, okay, people would rather, you know, watch a fun movie or read a fun book than think fun thoughts. But like, what about other less enjoyable activities? So Nick Butrick, for instance, did some studies like, would people rather think fun thoughts or proofread? You know, and it was like, well, it's about the same as proofreading. And it's like, well, what about other solitary, like unenjoyable activities, like giving yourself an electric shock? And we're like, well, Jim Cohn has a shock apparatus literally right down the hall, because he does these really cool studies of social baseline theory, where he looks at whether people experience less threat in the face of an electric shock if they're holding the hand of a partner or someone who's really close to them. He finds they do. But we knew he had this shock apparatus down there, and so we could do it. And what we found was that, you know, a decent percentage of folks actually went on and gave themselves electric shocks rather than simply sit and enjoy their own thoughts. And, you know, I don't think that means that thinking is torture. It just means that we're not really great at it, in part because it seems like we don't have a great sense of how to do it or how to succeed at it. And what we've found over the past decade is that when we give people kind of aids, where we give them, you know, list a few topics you'd like to think about. Here's that list of topics you just had. You can refer back to them now. That's so simple, but it actually makes the process easier, and they report they have an easier time concentrating. And that in turn makes the experience more enjoyable, which is so interesting to me, because it suggests that that's not what people are doing sort of spontaneously when we ask them to do this, that they're not sort of being like, oh, I could think of X, Y, and Z, and I'll keep those in mind and refer back to them mentally, that giving them that sort of process helps. And likewise, steering people towards meaningful but pleasant topics seems to help as well. So what we find very consistently is when we tell people to think about whatever you want, what they actually think about is planning their day. Which I don't know about you, but like, if I sit here and think about what I need to do in the next 24 hours, I'm like, okay, so there's this podcast with Eric, which is fantastic, of course, definitely lots of fun to think about. But, oh, you know, I need to get comments back to my grad student on her master's proposal. And I have that IRB application that I need to fill out. And, oh, I also owe edits on these two papers to someone else. And, you know, when you go through all these sorts of things, it's like, I at least feel anxious. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's all these things I need to do, but I'm not doing anything about them right now. And so what we sort of find is that people need some assistance in picking topics that are pleasant to think about. It really, you know, it's just a little nudge. It's like, hey, Eric, think about, you know, something you're looking forward to in the future, like going on a trip or graduating or getting tenure. Or, you know, hey, Eric, think about something really pleasant from your past. Like, you know, like when you graduated from high school or, you know, the first time you met a really important person in your life. That those little tiny, like really nudges in a sense seem to just sort of recalibrate people to be like, oh, I should be thinking about like these kinds of like meaningful, pleasant things, not things like what's in my Outlook calendar for tomorrow that I have to do. And so what that suggests to me is that when people are sitting down and trying to follow our instructions, it sounds more like they're sort of jumping to the end goal. Like, okay, I need to think fun thoughts, think fun thoughts, think fun thoughts, think fun thoughts. And they don't really think about what they need to do and the things that they need to think about and how they need to think in order for that experience to be enjoyable. That, again, you're sort of trying to leapfrog what it takes to have fun thoughts, to sort of have that. Have the outcome without going through the process that you need to get there.
And I think telling people what to think about is always better than telling them what not to think about, right? So Dan Wagner would say, you know, don't think of the white bear, and everyone thinks of a white bear. And maybe it's the same with like negative, like don't think of this terrible thing that happened to you. And everyone's going to think about this very thing for like forever, right?
I wonder if we could tell them, like, whatever it is, don't think about, you know, your high school graduation or whatever it is. Don't think about what's going to happen when COVID ends. Like, I wonder if we could, like, actually, I really love this idea. I wonder if we could, like, re-simulate some of the spontaneity of the kind of ways that, like, these thoughts occur in everyday life by telling people not to think about those kinds of topics rather than to do it intentionally. That'd be really fun.
And another thought that I had as I was reading it, I was like, one word just immediately popped into my mind, and it was meditation, because I love meditation. I've done it for years, and I'm really interested in it. But I also have to say, it's so damn hard, right? You can't just sit down and think about something for 30 minutes and not do anything else. And then in at least the kind of meditation that I do, I want to focus on like things that you're grateful for and think about specific things. And I feel like I'm really good at that for like 10 seconds. And then I think about how I still have to buy groceries and how I still have to do this homework assignment and all these different things. And I wonder if maybe if you had a longer time span in your experiments, maybe you would have found the same, that you give people these things to think about these positive experiences, whatever they are. And people might be like, yeah, I'm thinking about it. And then they're happy. But like 2 minutes later, they're like, oh God, groceries again. I don't know, but maybe I'm just pessimistic.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's funny. I said no, because I actually, so my undergraduate college at Reed, we had to take 6 quarters of PE, and they knew the kinds of students that went to Reed were not, you know, very PE type students. And so one of the classes we could take was meditation, which is why I'm very excited to tell you that I failed meditation. I didn't even get credit for the class. I've like flunked out of meditation class. So I am like legitimately bad at it, and I have the receipts to prove it. But you know, it is a very natural thing, I think, to think about, because in some ways meditation too is this very, you know, intensive regulatory way of regulating your own thoughts in ways that they don't normally go. And, you know, I will say, I don't think there's two things. One is we don't see a ton of evidence that meditation experience matters. So when we ask people, you know, how much prior experience do you have meditating? There's a small correlation with how much they enjoy thinking. And this is across like probably about 10,000 participants at this point. But it's a very, very small effect. We're talking like 1% of the variance. It's very, very small. That said, you know, I'm an experimental social psychologist, so I take all correlations with a grain of salt, including that one. And so it's entirely possible, you know, that that we didn't have the right population. It's entirely possible that if we actually, you know, did this study where we gave people, you know, 6 weeks of meditation training and then asked them to do our kind of, you know, thought experiment, that people would be better at it. And if they were, I would predict that it would mostly come from that sort of, you know, I talked about how people enjoy it more when they're able to concentrate successfully and when it's more meaningful. And the, typically we see this trade-off where thinking for pleasure, if you're thinking about the right things, is meaningful, but it's really hard. And so most people don't quite succeed at concentrating on it successfully. So it's meaningful, but hard to do. And so it's kind of like bleh. But, you know, if meditation improves people's sort of, you know, attentional regulation abilities, and so thinking's still really hard, but you're just, you know, better at it and you're more used to and you have more strategies for regulating your own thoughts, then in theory, that should make it more enjoyable as well. And like I said, we don't really see a ton of correlational evidence for it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not there. And I certainly would say we haven't really put that to a strong test. I would say all we have are sort of weak tests of that hypothesis, no real strong experimental evidence or even really looking for that association in the kind of population where you'd expect to see it.
And then one thing I also wanted to touch on is that it helps to have the goal of thinking positive thoughts, but it's probably just the goal of having a certain kind of thoughts, whatever they are, right? So, of course, immediately thinking about cultural differences and depending on your self-concept, some people might be like, I don't want to feel happy all the time. I want to have a balance between positive and negative and all these different things that are really interesting. But for the purposes of these studies, it probably doesn't really matter because whatever your goal is, you're more likely to get there if you set this as your goal in terms of like, these are the thoughts and the emotions that I want to feel.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We did. So Nick Buttrick looked at cross-cultural differences and whether, you know, so very early on when I was presenting this work at a conference in Germany, I had this very distinguished German scientist man raise his hand and be like, everyone knows that Americans can't think. Like,
wow.
Do you have any non-American samples? And I was like, and he was like, I came back and I was like, do we have any non-Americans? And we didn't at the time, but Nick, bless his heart, actually went and got data from, I think, 11 different countries, not Germany, actually. We did not get any Germans in this sample.
Pure spite, yeah.
I know, we're like, no Germans get to think in our study. But we did look, you know, really cross-culturally, like in Japan, in Korea, in the U.S., I think in Brazil, and, you know, a handful of other countries, to see whether, you know, there were sorts of cultural differences in this. And what we found is sort of, like you'd expect, that average sort of positive affect varied across countries. But when we asked people to think fun thoughts versus do fun things, that difference between how much more fun it was to every culture thought that doing fun things was more fun than thinking fun thoughts. Oh my God, I'm going to get myself into a tongue twister. But, and the difference was about the same, that doing was more fun than thinking pretty consistently across cultures and to an equal degree, but cultures themselves varied in how enjoyable they found the, you know, both experiences overall. So we sort of saw mean differences in affect across cultures, but not as a function of the condition of what we were asking people to do, which I was really surprised at. I really thought for all these different reasons, you know, like different cultural differences in ideal affect and cultural differences in what activities people tried to value. Like, I wouldn't have been stunned if it turned out that, you know, Americans were just really bad at thinking, not to diss on my own country for a second. But that's really not. We really found that this was surprisingly, at least for the countries we looked at, and at least big caveat in college samples. So, you know, it's less weird in some ways, but it's still weird in other ways. But we really didn't see any evidence that this was a culturally specific phenomenon. But I do love the idea of, like, you know, if you asked people to, like, think angry thoughts or, you know, think calm thoughts, like, would people be equally bad at those? Or not, in which you see these kinds of, you know, country level differences or even regional differences in how well people succeed at it, would be really fascinating.
Can I just state that as a German And speaking for all of Germany, I am not surprised to find that Americans are thinking after all. I want to apologize on his behalf. I'm not surprised by that finding. I saw that outside of this paper, you have some work on boredom and moral behavior or moral thinking, something related to morality. I study morality. I just have to ask, what's the connection here?
Yeah. So there's this whole idea. I sometimes joke that there's a bit of like culture wars with boredom, where we have all this evidence in the literature that boredom causes kind of bad things. So we have the electric shock data, which other people have gone back and done way better than we did with really rigorous controlled studies and found that, you know, boredom leads people to give themselves electric shocks. Boredom causes more snacking, which isn't moral, but like boredom causes, in research that my colleague and collaborator Stefan Fateiker did, I love these studies. He found, we find that boredom causes people to engage in sadistic behavior. So if you give people like little worms and a little coffee grinder, and then you make them bored, they're more likely to take the little innocent worms and grind them up in the coffee grinder for like, just for fun. The worms are actually fine. They get like shoveled off to the side. Like participants don't know that, but no worms were actually killed in this study. But they're like, they're mean to worms. They're mean to other people in the study. They like take people's pay away. And so sort of over and over, we see this empirical evidence that boredom is linked to all these sorts of negative outcomes. And many of them are moral. You know, they're these interpersonal, like being sadistic is generally not a morally advisable course of action. But at the same time, we see a lot of talk, especially in the popular press and sort of like popular media, about this idea that boredom is good, that like boredom can spawn creativity and, you know, innovative problem solving and all this. And I've always thought that that's really interesting because it suggests, and there's a little bit of evidence to support that, not as much, although it's not clear to me if that's just because we haven't looked for it or if it's just, or if it's not there. And so there's this really sort of interesting quandary where boredom sometimes seems to foster these sorts of positive pro-social behaviors, but in other situations fosters these really negative behaviors, these really antisocial, even sadistic behaviors. And so, I was asked to write this chapter about it, and I'm not a moral psychologist. So I asked someone who was, I said like, hey, Meltem Uzel, do you want to come like be a morality psychologist and I'll provide the boredom? And we ended up writing this chapter together that I really loved because it really brought the you know, these two sort of sides of our expertise together. And we have a number of sort of hypotheses and mechanisms that we've proposed for why boredom should sometimes result in positive, pro-social, morally, quote-unquote, good behavior, but why you also see that that same emotion in other contexts can sometimes result in this sort of morally bad behavior, quote-unquote. And, you know, one of those factors that we've proposed is just simply the environment that you're in, that if boredom tends to motivate action over inaction, that when you're in an environment that doesn't have a lot of good choices, you're going to see that boredom is motivating a lot of bad, potentially even immoral choices. And that boredom seems to sort of lower that threshold that we'd normally have against those kinds of behaviors. But when you have both positive and negative options available, that boredom may not have that effect anymore. You know, if boredom makes you go, oh, I want to do something, there's a good option and a bad option, you may be like, well, I'll do the good option. And we actually see that in some of the studies we've run, that if you give people the opportunity to, you know, you make them bored and then you give them the opportunity to dock someone's pay. If that's the only option, people will do it. Boredom increases the amount of pay that they dock. It increases the percentage of people that do it, et cetera. But if you take that same paradigm and this time you say, okay, you can press this button and it will dock Eric's pay. You press this other button, it will boost his pay by the same amount. The effect of boredom on this kind of antisocial behavior mostly goes away. That when you make this sort of positive alternative available, people sort of seem to funnel those action tendencies into that rather than into the sort of more like dubious, questionable behavior instead. And I really like that because I think something we need to do more of in emotion is taking that person and environment interaction seriously and thinking about like, you know, yeah, emotions happen within people, but they're informed, the emotions we feel are informed by the environment, but also the kinds of behaviors and actions we take that are available are informed by the environment as well. So there's this really nice sort of interplay between them. Yeah, stay tuned. Hopefully we have some other studies sort of up our pocket on boredom and morality. And I really would love to sort of test some of these more formally and actually show that like we can turn it on and off.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because in the media and in everyday life, you oftentimes encounter this narrative that's like, people are just terrible. They're beasts in disguise and we have to stop them with all these fancy institutions and all these things. And, you know, to some extent that's true. And people have some aggressive and sadistic impulses and some more than others. And, you know, let's not be naive about this, but it's also not true that people are just waiting to be aggressive and we constantly have to stop them. We also have these moral impulses. And, you know, if we're bored, it's not like we're just waiting for an opportunity to kill some worms or, you know, harm some people. just that, even though this is interesting enough, that if we have nothing else to do, then maybe we're going to do that. But once we have something good to do, something morally good to do, then we're going to jump at it. So I really like the narrative that these studies would suggest.
I really think, too, it's something to think about with folks who are in more constrained environments. So kids, for instance, in classrooms or, you know, any kind of people who are in environments where you don't have lots of good options. Because I think we almost make sort of this fundamental attribution error where like you put people in environments where they don't have good options. You make them bored. They do bad stuff. And then you're like, oh, those kids are terrible. You know, you make these person attributions about their morality when it really is the environment that if they, these same people had been in these environments that afforded more options, that you wouldn't have seen that kind of behavior at all. So you're sort of not only, it's sort of double blame. You're putting these people in these bad situations and then blaming them when they respond poorly to it.
And it's not only that we attribute something bad to their moral character, it's also we attribute the boredom to them, right? We're like, oh, they're bored because they're not interested in things. And they're not smart. They're just, you know, they're lost. And it's just like, I mean, you might blame this on COVID and be like, yeah, Zoom calls with teachers are not engaging. But I went to school, you know, back in the good old days before COVID when everything was in person. And let me tell you a secret. It was very boring most of the time. Right. And, you know, once I was at college where I got to study something I'm really interested in, I was so much more engaged in the classroom. And it's not like I had this big personality shift. Somewhere in between. It was just really the environment that was more stimulating.
No, I love this idea because I also had a similar experience and I think many academics do, but I love this idea that somehow we were all incredibly boring teenagers that turned into super interesting like 20 and 30 and upwards adults. No, exactly. It's we're actually, I have an undergrad who's doing an honors thesis right now that's doing a lens model of why we think other people are boring. So he's looking at like how boring you think you are and how boring like strangers rate you and how boring your like close friends rate you, which by the way, is kind of hilarious when I'm like, hey, can you tell me how boring you think Eric is? Like, it's like, but it feels bad. Like going back to your point, like it's not. No one wants to, in our culture, think that you're a boring person. So we're looking at some really fun studies looking at like what makes people think that they're boring themselves versus what makes them think that other people are boring. And in tandem with that, also looking at like, you know, sort of these like false lay beliefs about, you know, is it that only boring people get bored? Like, no, of course not. But we do see that people endorse that to some extent. And I don't know, you know, this is early preliminary evidence. I don't know if it'll hold up. But one of my favorite things that we've been seeing is that the more likely you are to report that you believe that only boring people get bored, the less bored you claim to be in our studies. So it's like, oh, I'm not a boring person, so I must not be bored, you know, like, or I'm not going to say it. That there's, I think there's some interesting impression management going on there. Because I'm pretty sure our studies are pretty gosh darn boring. I'm like, no, you were bored. I know you were. But yeah, no, I think it's really interesting too, the ways that we sort of assume that boredom is something about who you are rather than something about the situation that you're in to begin with.
Yeah, wow. So I'm really excited to see where this work is going. And what are some other projects that you have in mind or that you hope other people who might start research on boredom or who are already doing research on boredom, what are some future directions that you would like to see?
Yeah, so one of the things I would love to see across the board, no pun intended, is, I know, I'm so bad.
No, this was great.
So yeah, if you look at the literature on boredom, what you see is that almost all the studies are looking at trait boredom or boredom proneness, which is interesting, but you know, it's really an individual difference variable that doesn't say a whole lot about like why all of us get bored at times. And so if you actually look at just the number of studies that have looked at state boredom, like boredom as an emotion, we're talking less than 50 studies. You know, an undergrad could read them all in like a couple weeks. Which is amazing. And then if you look even further in, and you look at how many of those are actually experimental, you're down at less than a dozen. We know almost nothing about what boredom does because those experimental studies haven't been done. We've reviewed literally almost all of them we've talked about during this, you know, this chat today, and we didn't talk about that many. So, you know, it's saying something. And, you know, I sometimes hear like, when I was in grad school, I'd sometimes hear other students say things like, oh, I looked into it, but there's no literature, so I decided to do something else. And I'm always like, no. That's exactly the, you know, that no one's done it is yes, do that. And so I think really at this point, for almost any question that you're like, does boredom do X or does boredom do Y? For instance, does boredom cause alcohol use? Does boredom cause marijuana use? At best, what we've got are correlational studies. If they're really good, they're like longitudinal correlational studies. There aren't very many of those. There's no experimental work. And so anyone who's interested in like what boredom does, who is interested in experiments, I wouldn't mind if you just sort of pulled random behaviors out of a hat at this point, because we're working from such a low base rate of knowledge that even knowing that it doesn't cause, you know, a certain behavior is really helpful. You know, there's this whole debate about whether boredom causes creativity. And the quick answer is we don't really know. There's like one or two studies that have suggested that they do, but you can't base, you know, a conclusion like that on one or two studies. And so, you know, a registered report that really rigorously looked at, you know, boredom inductions on creative behavior, that would be amazing. So yeah, I think there's so many easy questions and like really easy studies to run that people just aren't. I think my quick answer would be future directions, both for me and for others, is experimental designs where the DV is an actual behavior, where it's not just, you know, correlating, you know, self-reported boredom with self-reported behavior, but that's actually looking to be like, okay, when we look at actual behavior, can we experimentally push that around by making people bored or not? And even then, you know, even if that just tells us what boredom can do, it doesn't tell us if boredom actually does it out in the wild. We have, this isn't published yet, but we have data from over 60,000 people during COVID where we looked at whether boredom predicts changes in social distancing and things over time. And cross-sectionally, there's a couple studies that find that it's correlated, that if you're the kind of person that says that you're bored more often, that you are also less likely to report adhering to social distancing guidelines. And we find that same thing too between participants, but because we have longitudinal data over like eight weeks of time points or more for some people, we can actually look and be like, okay, but if you're feeling more bored than usual one week, are you less likely to social distance the next week? And what we aren't seeing is any kind of these spillover effects. We're not seeing any kind of longitudinal predictive validity of boredom on these kinds of behaviors. And that's important because, you know, one of the concerns people have had with lockdown policies and things is like, hey, if these things make people bored, is it possible they're going to be less likely to follow them? And I think it's a very valid concern. And it's, you know, you see that association in between person level data, but we don't see it within person, which really suggests it's something about third variables or other things that's driving that association. It's not really something about boredom per se. So I think really any of this kind of research that pushes the boundaries of both experimentally, what can boredom do? And then out in the real world, do we see those same behaviors unfolding or not? So like, yeah, boredom might cause risk taking in the lab, at least in the context of the pandemic, we don't seem to see it playing out in the same way in real world behavior when we look at it, you know, over a span of weeks and time within person. So yeah, I'm really excited about, you know, I don't actually want to, you know, go to sleep and wake up in a year, but COVID has made me think that sometimes I do, but like, I would really love to go to sleep in a year and wake up and just see all the work that people have done on board, how we push things forward, because it's changing so rapidly. And it's really fun. I think we've all been bored at some point in time. And actually then sort of seeing a field and a sort of area of evidence unfold in real time for the first time is a great joy and really exciting. So I hope some folks listening to this do actually end up doing some boredom studies. And if you do, I really want to hear about it, because I think we need more of them.
Is there anything else you want our listeners to take away from this conversation? Academic listeners, non-academic listeners, your big message to the world?
Yeah. I think I'll end on this note, which is, you know, we've sort of, I love that we sort of traversed all these different topics from like thinking for pleasure to boredom to, you know, why is it so hard to sort of regulate our own thoughts or pursue happiness? And something that I think is sort of a common thread through all of these is this sort of mistaken lay belief about how emotions work, that, you know, that there's this sort of lay idea that, you know, emotions happen to us and force us to behave in certain ways. But, and, you know, maybe our academic listeners will know that, you know, that's not the case. But I think sometimes we sort of lose sight of it because it feels true. You know, it feels like I yelled at my dog because I got mad at her, you know. But emotions really work on us by giving us information about the world. And that's valuable, even if it doesn't always feel good in the moment. And we do have control both over the emotions that we feel and also how we react to it. You know, just because anger is telling me that, like, my dog's crossing the line by barking really loudly, I don't have to yell at her for it. I can, you know, do other things with that kind of information. And I think that's true with boredom, that when we feel bored, boredom is trying to tell us that what we're doing isn't meaningful or we're not able to engage intentionally in it right now. And it's giving us it's like an early dashboard signal that's giving us a chance to do something about it. And the same thing with thinking, you know, if you're having a hard time enjoying your own thoughts, you know, reflecting a little on like, well, why might that be the case? What can you change to change it? As opposed to just being like treating emotions as inevitable, kind of like we were talking earlier, where like, well, if you're bored, it's just because you're a boring person and there's nothing you can do about it. All right. You know, just because you're angry, you know, you're just an angry person. This idea that, that emotions in particular are really informative, that environments inform both what we feel, and, you know, sort of the options we have. But ultimately, you know, we do always have some agency in how we respond to it. I think it's something that I, at least during the pandemic, have tried to think more about when I feel bored, you know, being like, okay, like, yes, the situation's causing it. And yes, the situation's not giving me many good choices, but there are still some choices that I can make, you know, and I can choose not to stay on Reddit until 2 a.m. or, you know, like, there are more and less adaptive ways to react to these feelings or thoughts, as the case may be. So yeah, I think I'd just wrap up on that note.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. This was really, really fun.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for your patience with all our technological issues.
It was really fun. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.